Okay, so today we're going to finish up, try to quickly finish up dark matter enough that you guys can do the calculations, the sort of practice calculations in the tutorial this afternoon. Then we're going to quickly do baryogenesis at the end of lecture. Really just a short introduction. So this is, you know, the theory of what caused the observed matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe. And then tomorrow we push on to inflation and quantum field theory and curved space-time. Okay, but so let me, man wakes up on a stretcher and he looks up bewildered and he says, "Nurse, where are you taking me?" And she says, "To the morgue." And he's like, "Well, I'm not dead yet." She says, "Well, we haven't gotten there yet." Okay. That sounded like more like a courtesy laugh than a real laugh. So I push on with this line of jokes. So man wakes up on the stretcher, looks up alarmed, and he says, "Nurse, where are you taking me?" And she says, "To the morgue." And he says, "But I haven't died yet." And she says, "Well, the doctor said take you to the morgue, and so that's where we're going." And he says, "But what's wrong with me?" And she says, "The autopsy will show." Okay, you ready for a third? I could go all day with these until I get a genuine laugh. Okay. Okay. As I say, let's just try to finish off dark matter. So last time I tried to describe to you, you know, it's hard to give a totally coherent summary of what the observational evidence is for dark matter because it's kind of a web of interrelated things. But the basic thing I wanted to get across was that in a number of different to explain a number of different observations. Basically, anytime you want to account for a phenomenon in the early universe that we observe a relic of today, so that could be Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the light element abundances, or the detailed structure of the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, you need to invoke a certain amount of dark matter. And when you observe the universe today, when you observe the universe today on scales larger than a galaxy or equal to or larger than a galaxy, you also find you end up needing to invoke dark matter. But despite our best efforts, all of these things are just they're purely to fix gravity in these systems. We only have gravitational evidence for dark matter in any of these systems. On the other hand, that evidence is to a large extent consistent between these various guys. It seems to be the case that you need to invoke the same amount of dark matter with the same basic properties, that it's basically a cold, collisionless gas of non-relativistic particles in all of these guys. Okay, so there seems to be a lot of consistent evidence for dark matter, but it's all gravitational. And so the first thing we said is, well, there are two possible lines of explanation. It could be that Einstein's gravity is wrong and we need modified gravity. Traditionally, this was a less popular route. I mentioned that just very recently there has been a big breakthrough on this side. The people who made this breakthrough, I don't think even don't think of it as an explanation for dark matter, but they think of it as more hopefully an explanation for the cosmological constant problem. So I think it's very worth taking seriously and exploring, which it hasn't yet been really properly explored as a as an explanation to everything. But the more conventional opinion is that dark matter is actually an extra matter component whose nature we're still trying to uncover. We were just trying to outline what are the possibilities? What could it be? What apparently is it not? So first, you can ask, well, This dark matter is distributed through the universe. Is it distributed in microscopic particles or in macroscopic particles? So MACHOs, basically dark macroscopic objects, massive compact halo objects, presumably black holes, or WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. So one thing I didn't have a chance to mention yesterday is why is this not considered a strong contender these days? So to make a long story short, it was pointed out in the 80s that if the dark matter in our galaxy is made up of massive black holes, that you'll be able to detect those because basically using so-called gravitational microlensing. So basically we're in the galaxy here, and it's full of black holes that we can't see directly. But then we monitor a bunch of distant stars. Okay, so we're here, this is our eye. We monitor a bunch of distant stars. And when a black hole, if the halo is really full of black holes, then they have a non-negligible probability of crossing very close to the line of sight between us and a star if we monitor enough stars. And when they do that, there's this phenomenon called microlensing, which happens where basically what you see, you can show that what you see is that if the star is intrinsically emitting just a constant intensity, as the black hole passes in front of it, you see a bump in its intensity, like this. You don't actually see. So really, if your telescope was powerful enough, you would see that what this bump is really coming from is that gravitational lensing is sending you to it for a brief time. You're seeing two comparably bright images coming around both sides of the intervening black hole, and then the sum of those two images is adding up to more than the individual image that you're seeing in the unlensed case. So anyway, the bottom line is that people did concerted experiments to look for the signature, and the absence of the predicted signature in those experiments tells you that basically there are no WIMPs, there are no MACHOs. The dark matter is not made of MACHOs from about 100 times the mass of our sun down to about 10 to the minus 8 times the mass of our sun. Okay, so over about the 10 orders of magnitude, over the very large range of masses that this observation can probe, which are arguably would have been the expected mass range, because that's where on the one hand we know how you would form astrophysical black holes. We see black holes in this mass range. We know they exist, but on the other hand, they're not so huge that we would see them in other ways. There is a gap from 10 to the 8 down to 10 to the minus 18 times the mass of the sun. So this is about the mass of Mount Everest. Once we get down to 10 to the minus 18 in the mass of the sun, that's pretty. So between these two masses, that there's no really good constraint. And then 10 to the minus 18 on downward, if you're a black hole that's smaller than the mass of Mount Everest, turns out you evaporate by Hawking evaporation in less than the age of the universe. So those guys can't be the dark matter because they just don't live long enough. They don't live until the present time. But if you want to be a MACHO, if you want the dark matter to be MACHOs, you have to be in this mass range of black holes, which is currently unconstrained. Now there's no particularly good model. You know, it just kind of looks bad for MACHOs. Everywhere you can look, the evidence is against them. It could be that they're hiding in the one range that you can't look in. That's possible. I don't think there's any terribly great model that predicts, terribly compelling model that predicts the dark matter to be black holes in this mass range. But it's still, strictly speaking, is allowed. But for that reason, this guy is not the main one that is normally considered by cosmologists today. Okay, so then there are WIMPs, and as we said, that broke into the possibilities for WIMPs basically broke into two categories. First of all, either these are some particles, and either they were in thermal equilibrium in the early universe at some point before they fell out of thermal equilibrium, before they froze out, in which case they're thermal relics. In that case, you can say a lot about them. The fact that you know the initial condition, that they were initially in thermal equilibrium, tells you a lot about them. Or maybe they never were. Maybe they were non-thermal relics. And again, the thermal relic breaks into two cases. It froze out either, must have frozen out either when it was relativistic, in which case it's called a hot thermal relic, or when it was non-relativistic. Okay, and so it's good to go through the, you know, the first thing to say is that taking a step back, so I'm on the tutorial this afternoon, you'll go through the cold thermal relic calculation and the non-thermal relic calculation. So this is, and I just want to here describe, just sketch a little bit of the physics enough, just enough that you'll be able to go through those calculations on your own. But yeah?
Maybe I'm misremembering, but I thought that if you have relativistic matter and the temperature drops, then the matter becomes non-relativistic. It's number density is suppressed exponentially as the temperature becomes colder, then the non-relativistic matter can be frozen. Its number density changing can be frozen up. So I thought that as the temperature, I thought that freeze out occurs just as the temperature drops sufficiently, and I thought that as the temperature drops sufficiently, relativistic matter has to go through that non-relativistic stage and then freeze out. So how could you have freeze out just in the relativistic stage?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. So we'll talk about that in a minute. So the neutrino is it depends on what your couplings, what are the couplings that hold you in contact with everybody else are. So the neutrino is an example of a particle that we actually know of, that is an honest to God thermal relic. It froze out. It decoupled from the rest of the universe at about when the temperature was about 1 MeV at about the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, when it was highly relativistic. So it's true that in other cases, one mechanism to freeze out is that you're massive, the temperature goes below your mass, your number density gets so dilute that you can no longer maintain thermal equilibrium. But more generally, there's some reaction that holds you in thermal equilibrium, and it scales with temperature in some way. And then there's the Hubble rate, and it scales with temperature in some way. And when they, at some point, they if they scale with temperature in two different ways, they'll cross at some point. And depending on your mass and depending what the reaction is that keeps you in thermal equilibrium, you may or may not be relativistic when that crossing occurs, when you freeze out. The hot thermal relic calculation, actually, I hadn't described it in these terms yet, but that was the calculation that you did on Thursday's tutorial last week. So Thursday last week, one of the things that you guys calculated was that neutrinos froze out at this temperature of 1 MeV. So I actually was not going to go through that calculation again, but you can have a look at the tutorial, and it's also in the lecture notes, that the calculation of how that goes, if you want to check it. Okay, but so I also just want to say, first of all, these guys, in addition to being the calculations that tell us what we do and don't know about particle dark matter, they're also just very important. They illustrate a bunch of very important techniques for just assessing when you have a new model of physics, is it or is it not consistent with cosmology? And so, you know, what can I say about these calculations? They're a little bit inelegant. Like, you have to plug in numbers, and you have to, like, it's just basically writing down, you know, two sides of an equation and solving for a quantity. It's somehow, the calculations are not beautiful, but they are very important. I just want to say that I'm teaching them to you not to torture you, but because at least one of you has to go off and win a Nobel Prize, and I'm telling you that this is like, a significant part of the toolkit that is required for you to do that. It's a likely thing that you will need to do to determine, to keep yourself on the road to a correct theory as opposed to one that completely conflicts with observations. Yes. Sorry? Say it one more time.
Did I award Nobel Prizes to kangaroos?
That's, I mean, my impression is that this guy is being very attentive. When I kind of scan the audience and think about who are the people who are about to rebel and who are the ones who are, I'm not looking at you, kangaroo. Okay. So, but good question. Okay, so what? I mean, all right. Okay. So let's just. So as I said, I'm going to be most brief about the hot thermal relic calculation. Let's talk about that guy first, because you really already did that calculation in Thursday's tutorial. You just didn't describe it in these terms. So let's just briefly review the idea. Okay, as I said, as I was just saying, it can happen that, you know, ultimately there's some reaction that keeps a particle in thermal equilibrium, keeps it in equilibrium with the rest of the thermal bath. It scales with T in some way, or it scales with the scale factor in some way. Then there is the Hubble rate, which scales with T or with the scale factor A in some way. And at sufficiently early times, this guy is bigger than this guy, the particle is in thermal equilibrium. At sufficiently late times, unless they happen to scale in exactly the same way, this guy will drop below this guy, the particle will freeze out. That if that's sufficiently early, if that happens when T is greater than the mass of the particle, then the particle will freeze out when it's still relativistic. And again, the neutrino is a proof of principle that this can happen in the real world. The neutrino actually does this. It is a hot relic. Okay, and the basic point of the calculation was the following. The idea that you repeat in each of these calculations, the detailed physics is different, but the basic argument is the same. You say, okay, let me calculate the moment at which the species freezes out. I always do that by calculating, identifying the relevant rate, reaction rate, and finding out when it crosses the Hubble rate. Then, the next step of the calculation is also basically the same thing repeated again and again. You just say, okay, after that, after my relic particle chi freezes out, its number density, I imagine it's some stable relic particle. So suddenly it freezes out, now it's just a stable particle, it doesn't talk to anybody. So the number of those particles is conserved as the universe expands, but the volume of the universe is increasing as a cubed. So the number density of that particle goes as 1 over a cubed. On the other hand, under the assumption that the universe expanded quasi-adiabatically in between freeze-out and today, so under the assumption that there was no huge violent phase transitions, or, well, let me just, there are scenarios in which this assumption is violated, but in any case, under the assumption that the universe expands quasi-adiabatically and there's no significant entropy production, the entropy is also conserved. Again, so about the same argument, it also scales as 1 over a cubed. So the number density of chi particles over s is conserved between the moment of freeze-out and today. So, in other words, n chi at freeze-out over s at freeze-out is equal to n chi today over s today. And so this equation lets us predict, you know, typically the point is that we know these three quantities and we're trying to predict this guy. So, okay, so we know the relativistic entropy density of the universe today. It's basically the entropy density of the CMB plus the neutrinos. Approximately, it's the entropy density of the CMB. We're just trying to see whether things are in the right. I mean, for these purposes, we're just first trying to see if things are in the right ballpark, or are they off by like 300 orders of magnitude. So order one factors are not so crucial. Using the formula that we calculated in lecture 7, you can calculate. This is what you'll do on the homework in the tutorial for the hot thermal relic and cold thermal relic cases. You can just use our thermodynamic formula to calculate what was the entropy density of the thermal bath at freeze out, what was chi at what was the number density of chi particles at freeze out, what was the entropy density today. So you can calculate the number density of chi particles today. And then at the end of the day, you say, OK, well then, if these chi particles are non-relativistic matter today, or whatever they are, but in the case where their masses are large enough that they'll be non-relativistic matter, if you're trying to model the dark matter, then their energy density will be approximately just their rest mass. In their non-relativistic limit, their energy is dominated by their rest mass times their number density today. And you have to just ask, is that energy density today equal to, can it be equal to 25% of the critical density today, which again is a known quantity. And you know, if so, what constraints does that put on the parameters of the model? So the story in the hot thermal relic case was we did a calculation exactly like that. And the basic point was that, okay, if you froze out an equilibrium, then at the moment of freeze out, a relativistic species is a relativistic species. So if chi froze out when it was relativistic, at the moment of freeze out, its abundance was about equal to the abundance of photons at freeze out. But then both of these things scaled as a to the minus 3 between then and now. So its abundance today is also about equal to the abundance of photons today, which is known. So if you take the known abundance of photons today to be the abundance of these chi particles today, which is what you get if they froze out when they were relativistic, and then you multiply that by the hypothetical mass of the chi particle to get its energy density, and then you demand that that's less than or equal to 25% of the critical density, then the thing you checked in Thursday's tutorial last week was that this demands that the mass of the chi particle is less than a very small mass by particle physics standards, 10 eV. The only particle that we know of that's whose mass is less than this in the standard model is the neutrino. Everything else has a mass way bigger than this, well, except for the photon, which is massless. Okay, so you get a very tight bound on the mass of any hot thermal relic, including the neutrino, or any other putative dark matter candidate that froze out in this way. And basically, this rules it out. Dark matter cannot have such a low mass. Very briefly, why? So, okay, the reason that light dark matter like this, turns out that if the mass of a dark matter particle is less than about 10 to the 3 eV, that guy is ruled out if it's a thermal relic because this guy remained relativistic until the temperature of the universe. It froze out when it was relativistic, and then after it froze out, its momentum went down as 1 upon A, and the temperature went down as 1 upon A. So if you think it through, this guy only became non-relativistic when the temperature dropped, when the temperature of the thermal bath dropped to be about equal to its mass. But if its mass is only 10 eV, that means this guy was relativistic. It was like behaving like a photon streaming across the universe at the speed of light until quite late in the game, until the temperature of the universe dropped to 10 eV. I mean, that's getting close to when the CMB was released. That's we're talking about like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years after the Big Bang. Tens of thousands of years. So the point is that if this dark matter particle was streaming across the universe for such a long time, that okay, so you know, in the early universe there's some distribution of peaks and valleys in the density, just some random noisy distribution, some big peaks and some small peaks, random noisy distribution. But if the dark matter can randomly stream across the universe by this distance, before these are peaks in the dark matter distribution into which ultimately the rest of the atoms in the universe are going to fall. If the dark matter manages to be relativistic and stream this far before becoming non-relativistic, it will effectively smear out this distribution on scales smaller than this radius. So it'll basically leave the biggest, it'll leave the clumps and it'll leave the peaks in the dark matter distribution that are bigger than that, but it'll wipe out structure on scales smaller than this radius. And the problem is, okay, now here I'm not going to go into details about this, but just that we see that, you know, if you calculate what this distance is for 10 to the 3 EV, we see structure has grown on that scale in the universe. Okay, on that scale and larger, structure has grown. So the dark matter had better not be able to just stream and wipe out structure on scales any larger than that. Okay, so the point is, a thermal relic with a mass less than 10 to the 3 EV stayed relativistic so long and was able to free stream so far that if it existed, it would have wiped out structures in the universe. It would have wiped out the dark matter potential wells on length scales where we observe that structure actually has grown in the universe. Okay, so it's inconsistent with observations. I think that's all I wanted to say about that. I don't want to go through that calculation in any more detail because it's a little bit... because it's a little bit too much of a mess to do here. But okay, so let's now just briefly, equally briefly, without going through any of the details, sketch the cold thermal relic calculation. This maybe is the one to know about. This is the one where something actually is a success. Instead of just doing a calculation and finding, oh, the dark matter can't be that, you actually do a calculation and the result says like, oh, that actually seems pretty reasonable. That could be the right answer. So, let's see. Before I say it, I know this topic is a little bit uglier. It's like a little bit. Again, it's like not, or at least for me, it's like not as geometrical as, you know, somehow differential geometry. So the joke. I think the joke frequency will need to be higher. I stress to you, it's equally important. But I know that if you're like me, your mind is recoiling at the moment. So Vovichka, do you guys remember Vovichka? We met him. He was the kid in the room at the end of the hall. So he is invited to a birthday party with his fellow kindergartners, and they get to the birthday party, and everybody, all the children are dressed in different colors in their party clothes. It's a costume party, and so. You know, one of the mothers asks, "Oh, you know, what are you dressed as?" Little child number one, who's dressed in purple, and they say, "I'm dressed as grapes." And child number two is dressed in yellow, and says, "I'm dressed as a banana." You know, child number three is dressed in orange, and they're dressed as an orange, and Vovichka is dressed in gray, and he says, "I'm dressed as gray." So Vovichka, you can see, think about what Vovichka is going to grow into. I mean, he's going to be like in this class pretty much. I'm just joking. Cold dark matter. Was it even refreshing? Was it just like a little bit? I know it didn't actually produce a laugh, but did it have? Would you say it had any positive effect? I don't know. If there could just be like a thread of drool that gets pulled back into your mouth by virtue of me telling the joke, I'll be satisfied. So cold thermal relics. So the idea here is the standard picture here is that there's this massive chi particle now. The temperature drops below its mass. Okay. So its number density wants to get exponentially suppressed by the Boltzmann factor. But the reaction that sets its number density is some reaction of the form chi annihilates with another chi or an anti-chi to some other particle that is in thermal equilibrium. Let's say two photons in the standard case. And as you'll argue for yourself in the tutorial today, you know, the rate for that reaction is that annihilation is something like the annihilation cross section for that reaction. So the chi self-annihilation cross section times the number density of chi particles times their typical velocity. And again, at some point that may fall below. You'll calculate that can fall below the Hubble rate. And at that point, the reaction will freeze out. And instead of continuing to exponentially decline, you'll have some residual number of chi particles who are stable on their own. And if they can't find another chi particle to annihilate with, they have nothing left to do but just stick around until the end of the universe. So what happens here? Well, if the interaction cross section, if the annihilation cross section between two chi's is very big, then this rate is very large. They stay in thermal equilibrium longer, and so they experience more and more exponential suppression before freezing out. So if their annihilation cross section is big enough, they'll annihilate away to an exponentially small abundance, negligible abundance in the universe today. On the other hand, if their annihilation cross section is too small, they'll freeze out early on. Not much suppression will take place, and then you have a problem. You have a particle whose abundance freezes out at too large a value, and then it can come to dominate the universe today. Have far too much when you calculate its abundance today times its number. If you calculate its energy density today, its mass times its number density today, its Rayleigh number density, it's far too large. It's far bigger than that. It can be far bigger than the critical density. That's a very common problem you have when you write down a model that goes beyond the standard model. It can very easily have a particle like this, and that guy's just ruled out. You know, you have to know to be able to rule out a particle on that grounds. I mean, a model on those grounds. But the interesting thing is that for a very natural choice of cross-section and mass, namely, if you just take the cross-section to be the sort of standard weak annihilation cross-section, and you take the mass to be the typical mass of baryons in the universe, 1 GeV, then turns out you go through this calculation and what you actually find is it's right in the middle. It predicts that the energy density of this particle today is of order the critical density, which is what we observe. We observe that the dark matter density today is of order the critical density. So that is kind of nice. That's the so-called WIMP miracle that you will check. That's one of the calculations that you'll check in the tutorial this afternoon. Miracle, I would say, is too strong a word, but it's the WIMP bit of encouragement. So now non-thermal relics. It's worth also mentioning the physics here because we're going to come back to it shortly when we talk about the simplest model of inflation in the early universe. So the simplest non-thermal relic is just an extra scalar field that you add to the Lagrangian. So we have the Lagrangian, we have Einstein gravity, and then we have the Lagrangian of the standard model here. And then let's just imagine we add one extra degree of freedom, just a single scalar field phi that doesn't talk to anybody else except gravity. Okay, so suppose that is the action of nature. And also just suppose that this potential is the simplest potential. Let's just say it's just 1/2. It's just a mass term. 1/2 some constant mass squared times phi squared. That's just a label. Okay, so what is what does this model do? Well, let's first the first thing that you'll do in the tutorial is just calculate the equation of motion for the phi particle. You can calculate it in two ways. One thing you can do is vary phi in the action here. Just the normal way you would calculate the equation of motion for phi. And in any case, you find that the equation of motion is. You know, the relativistic, general relativistic version of the Klein-Gordon equation. You can get the same equation of motion alternatively just by stress energy conservation. If you calculate this, if you use your formula to calculate the stress energy tensor for phi by varying g in the action. Remember, we learned about that in lecture two. Take the stress energy tensor and then you demand that it's conserved. That'll lead you back to the same equation. So now, if you just expand out these covariant derivatives, you know, we've already calculated the Christoffel. To expand out these covariant derivatives, you need to know the forms for the Christoffel symbols in the FRW universe. Fortunately, you already calculated those on a previous lecture. They're simple. So if you just plug those in, then the equation of motion, if we plug those in for the FRW universe, and first we just want to understand what the homogeneous behavior of phi is. Assume phi has no spatial dependence. Assume it doesn't fluctuate in space. Let's just deal with its homogeneous evolution first. Then its equation of motion looks like this. Okay, phi double dot plus, 3h phi dot plus m squared phi. Okay, so now, what's the behavior? Well, and again, hopefully you'll have a chance to think this through more in the tutorial. So this is the equation for a damped harmonic oscillator. Like if this guy wasn't here, then phi double dot plus m squared phi. Well, if you just called m omega, this would be phi double dot plus omega squared phi is equal to zero. That's just the equation for a simple harmonic oscillator, and then here's a friction term that's proportional to the velocity of phi dot. The only difference is that this h, normally when you meet a damped harmonic oscillator in freshman physics or in first year physics, this is taken to be some constant with units of frequency. Here h is time dependent. That's the crucial difference. Okay, so, but you know, you're used to this fact that when the friction term h is bigger than the frequency omega, so in this case, when h is bigger than m, this is a very overdamped oscillator. So basically, the field just gets pinned. So on its potential when it's very overdamped. Basically, that's the limit where you can ignore this term, and you can just solve this equation. And what happens in that limit is the field just oozes and comes to a stop at some point. It's pinned at some point on the potential. So that's the situation in the early universe. In the early universe, h, the Hubble expansion rate, is very big, bigger than whatever the mass of the particle is. And so its initial condition is that it's pinned on the potential. This term is negligible. Then, when h drops, eventually it becomes smaller than m. The universe's expansion slows down until h is smaller than m. And so that's the situation where this becomes an underdamped oscillator. So basically, the particle is the field is released. So here I'm plotting v of phi is equal to 1/2 m squared phi squared versus phi. So the field value is initially pinned away from the origin of its potential, away from the minimum, but then it's at some point in the universe when the transition takes place. At some point when the transition takes place, when h is approximately equal to m, as the universe cools past that point, suddenly the field becomes underdamped and is free to oscillate. And as you'll show in the tutorial, the way it actually oscillates is, well, on timescales corresponding to one oscillation, it acts just like a simple harmonic oscillator. It oscillates with constant amplitude. But ultimately, this friction term is still there, and what you'll find is that actually phi oscillates as a to the minus 3/2 times cosine mt. So the frequency of the oscillation is to a good approximation set by this mass, but the amplitude gradually declines as a to the minus 3/2 as a grows. I think that's maybe all I wanted to explain here. The rest of it you'll go through in the tutorial. But again, the basic idea is the same. At the moment when suddenly the field begins to oscillate, you calculate its number density. You compare that to the that's the analog of freeze out. That moment is the analog of freeze out. Nothing actually froze out, but that's suddenly the moment at which this field began to behave like a massive particle. Because that's what a massive particle does. It oscillates in a massive particle in Minkowski space has this potential where its wave function oscillates in it. The remaining steps are the same as before. You'll just use this equation. You'll find that you can calculate everything in here. Except for the quantity that you want, the number density of the chi particles today. So you calculate that using this equation, and then calculate the energy density of those particles today, and see whether they can or cannot be the dark matter. What is the condition for them to be the dark matter versus yeah? Yes, sorry about that. Yes, I don't know. So somehow chi is my general letter meaning a relic massive particle. But in fact, you're right. I'm just being confusing. This one, we're here talking about phi.
And so this is a candidate?
Yeah. So it turns out that the so-called axion, this scenario does not have any associated miracle, like it doesn't have any. There's no sense in which the abundance just comes out right without having to fix parameters. But this scenario has the advantage that, well, both the WIMP scenario and this scenario have the advantage that there is a proposed extension of the standard model. That is motivated by non-cosmological considerations. So in this case, for setting aside cosmology, people wanted to complete the standard model with a supersymmetric extension, and then that supersymmetric extension violates has baryon number violation and also has flavor-changing neutral currents, and so you insert this thing called R-symmetry to fix those problems. Then when you do that, you say, oh, voila, suddenly I have a new stable particle in the theory. R symmetry makes the lightest superpartner stable. So that maybe that's a dark matter candidate. It can have about this cross-section and about this mass and can be a good dark matter candidate as a result of this calculation. Now, increasingly, it can't actually have this cross-section and this mass. That's what the LHC is telling us. That motivation is actually getting worse and worse rapidly right at the moment. But then over here, there's a problem in the standard model called the so-called strong CP problem. There's a certain parameter that's permitted to be there in the standard model. We would expect it to be of order 1. Instead, observationally, we just have an upper bound that is less than 10 to the minus 9. So a proposed extension of the standard model due to Pecci and Quinn is supposed to solve that problem. It inevitably, as was pointed out by Weinberg and Wilczek, has an extra particle that an extra scalar field called the axion which basically behaves exactly like this, and so again it's an extension of the standard model that has a plausible dark matter candidate So that's maybe the main example to keep in mind. Okay, so as I say, that's just enough of a sketch to let you think through the details this afternoon. Again, I just stress that a little bit of practice with this sort of thinking is really important. Anyone who's going to be working on any aspect of fundamental physics should probably do this at some point in their life. It is a highly underdeveloped skill in most physicists. I keep apologizing for the fact that the calculations are kind of inelegant and that the formulae that you get have things to gross powers, and with you have to plug in, you know, actual numerical values of what is the temperature of the CMB and units of EV or something like that. But a little bit of practice along these lines, I swear it's good for you. I would be going too far to say that you have to thank me in your Nobel speech. I don't want to go that far, but I just want to say, don't be angry at me. Okay, baryogenesis. So, in order to explain why the universe is full of matter today and no antimatter, in the abundance that we see, what had to be the case was that earlier in the universe, before the baryons and antibaryons annihilated, when the universe was above a temperature of 1 GeV, that for every billion antiprotons, there were a billion plus one protons. So that when they annihilated, one lonely proton had nobody to annihilate, and just sadly hung around until something interesting began to happen later on. Okay, so we want to explain, this is like one of the basic numbers that the universe hands to us that we currently don't have an explanation for. It may be one of our great hints about physics beyond the Standard Model. Yeah? So this is the ratio of the number of, so the idea is that at early times, the number of protons and antiprotons were relativistic species, just like the photon. So their number density was just the same as the photon number density. But then after annihilation, their relic number density, we measure that, and we can measure that in a couple of independent ways. I was saying you need to know that number in order to get the predicted light. That's the one free parameter that enters into the Big Bang nucleosynthesis calculation of the abundances of hydrogen and helium and lithium and their isotopes. And it also is one of the crucial free parameters that you need to tune to get the spectrum of fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background correct. So in both of those ways, you get a consistent answer. You find both of those things force you to take the number of protons in the universe today divided by the number of photons in the universe today to be about 10 to the minus 9. But that's exactly, those protons are exactly this leftover guy. So that's how I know that it's 10 to the minus 9. We have never observed a baryon being created or destroyed. So if the total, if the net baryon number here was positive, a proton has one unit of baryon, a neutron has one unit of baryon number. Every time you have three quarks, that's every quark has one-third unit of baryon number. Every antiquark has minus a third. So we've never observed a process in the laboratory that violates baryon number. It's known to be a stupendously good, but not exact, symmetry of the Standard Model at low energies. It's slightly anomalous. So you could just say that your first reaction would be, whatever asymmetry between matter and antimatter we observe in the universe today, then apparently if that's conserved, if it's perfectly conserved, that just had to be put in as an initial condition at the beginning of the universe. The universe just somehow started with a part in a billion more matter than antimatter. Okay, but that's not the modern view. For one thing, we know that the standard model itself, if you heat it up to high temperatures above the electroweak phase transition, above a TeV, it violates baryon number like crazy. Secondly, the sort of most compelling extensions of the standard model based on grand unification, they also all violate baryon numbers. So the modern perspective is that the conservation of baryon number is a low temperature and low energy phenomenon, probably not true at high temperatures. So even before people figured that out, Sakharov a Soviet genius decided that that was just a more appealing picture of how baryon number could be created in the early universe. He just thought this idea of putting it in as the initial conditions sounded ugly, and he said, well, you know, wouldn't it be nicer if instead of an initial condition we just modified? Probably the correct thing is that in the early universe there was no net baryon number, and then it's just the dynamical laws that created baryon number out of nowhere. So at the time, that sounded like a wacky suggestion because there was no indication at that time that the laws of nature exhibited baryon number violation. So he thought through the scenario, and he said, in fact, you need three things to be true. If you want this picture to be true, and this is now our modern picture, it's regarded to be likely correct, although we don't know. It's regarded as, let's say, the most appealing picture we have at the moment of where the baryon asymmetry came from. That there was zero initially, and then it was created dynamically rather than by virtue of the initial conditions. So he argued that in order for that to be the case, the fundamental theory of nature had to have baryon number violation. That's pretty obvious. If you're going to go from zero net baryon number to non-zero net baryon number had better be violated in that theory. He also argued that you had to have C and CP violation, where again, I think, now here I'm confused about the, I'd have to go back and look at the history. It's possible he also was suggesting these before. When was CP violate? I think he was suggesting, I think maybe this suggestion came in the mid-60s before the actual observation of CP violation in the standard model. Anyway, that's an aside. And you also need violation of thermal equilibrium for the basic reason. So the whatever process created baryon number had to do so in a way that was out of thermal equilibrium, violated thermal equilibrium. It can't just be that in the quasi adiabatic expansion of the universe, everything remained at thermal equilibrium at all times, for the basic reason that in that case, basically, even if you find some process, some CP violating and baryon violating process decay that produces net baryons from no initial net baryons, that the inverse process, thermal equilibrium, holds the inverse process in exact balance with that process. And so all the baryon number that you create gets washed out by the inverse process to the same degree. So these are called the Sakharov conditions. I just wanted to say the one that is probably most confusing is this guy. So I just wanted to explain a little bit more why you need C and CP violations. So going back to our distribution functions that we introduced when we were talking about thermodynamics in the universe. So we had some distribution function that told us how the particles were statistically distributed in phase space at a given time, how the ith species was distributed, and so we're gonna use the approximation that the early universe was very homogeneous. So these guys are independent of position. They only depend on momentum and time. And the universe is isotropic. That is, every direction is statistically the same. So the distribution function doesn't depend on the direction of the momentum, only on its magnitude. Okay, and so then the argument is just, well, Sakharov's proposal is that the universe started off in a state where the distribution functions, where there were the same number of particles and antiparticles. So the distribution function for the ith species was the same as the distribution function for its antiparticle. So at some early time, t initial, every particle species had the same distribution function as its antiparticle. But at some later time, that was supposed to be not true. So now if you just think about how do the various discrete symmetries act on these guys? How does C and CP? So what P does, parity, that is to say, it flips all spatial directions. So it takes the position x to minus x. Well, these guys, we've used homogeneity to get rid of their spatial dependence, so that doesn't do anything. It takes all momenta to the opposite of the three momenta. But again, we've used isotropy to have these guys only depend on the direction, on the magnitude of p, not on its direction. So again, parity does nothing to these guys. Charge conjugation, on the other hand, swaps particles and antiparticles. So it interchanges the distribution functions fi and fi bar. The distribution function for a particle and its antiparticle. And so CP, the combination, also interchanges because CP does both things. It does this, which again is trivial in our case, but it also does this. So in both C and CP, if you act on the initial state with P, well, P does nothing. So P leaves it invariant. So we have a P invariant initial state. We also have a C invariant initial state because if you replace fi with f bar I, that you haven't done anything because in the initial state f and f bar are the same. So the initial state is invariant under P, CP, and C. But the final state is not. Now if I act with this guy, act on this guy with P, it's invariant. So the final state is still P invariant. So I don't have to violate parity conservation to get from here to here, to get from a P invariant state to a P non-invariant state. But the final state is not C and CP invariant. If I replace fi by f bar I, well, those two things are not equal. So the state is not invariant under that replacement. So the initial state has P, C, and CP, but the final state has P, but it violates C and CP. Okay, so to get from a C and CP invariant state to a C and CP non-invariant state, I had better violate C and CP along the way. Okay, so now just in 1 minute to make it a little bit more concrete, because then unfortunately we have to leave this topic. We only have a little bit of time for this guy. Just a concrete example. So this is actually how grand unified theories behave. They have particles, massive particles that you don't see at low energies, massive particles that are not present in the standard model. But they exhibit baryon number violating decays. Okay, so they may have two decay channels. So they exhibit baryon number violation in the sense that this guy does not have a well-defined baryon number because it can decay in two different ways to two different outcomes that have different baryon, two different states with different baryon number. So it can decay to one set of particles that have total baryon number b1, and let's say that the branching ratio for that decay is r. okay, a fraction r of the time it goes that way. It can also decay to a state with B2 the remainder of the time, a fraction 1 minus r of the time. Okay, but then it also has an antiparticle, and so the corresponding anti-decays are available to the antiparticle. So it can decay in two ways, to a state with minus B1 or a state with minus B2. And the branching ratio for this guy is R bar, and the branching ratio for this guy is 1 minus R bar. Okay. So now the idea is that, so it turns out CPT symmetry, I maybe don't have time to explain this, but so CPT symmetry guarantees that a particle and its antiparticle, they have the same total decay rate. So the total rate at which the x particle decays, x, is the same as the total rate at which the x bar decays, but again, they both have two decay channels. The total decay rate is a sum of two partial decay widths, and these two guys do not individually have to be equal. It's only the sum that has to be equal. Okay, so in particular, the branching ratio here, R, between this guy and this guy, does not have to be the same as the branching ratio down here, R bar and 1 minus R bar. And in fact, it's exactly when the theory is CP violating, C and CP violating, that R and R bar are free to be not equal to one another. Okay, so let's just briefly calculate. If you want to calculate so imagine at some point in the early universe, the X particle freezes out. We go through, we find the moment of freeze out, we calculate its equilibrium abundance. So at the moment of freeze out, its number density over the entropy density is nx over s freeze out. So now how many? So then we wait a little while, they decay. What is the baryon density per entropy density, the thing that we want to produce, the thing that we want to be 10 to the minus 10? When these x particles decay, how much baryon density per entropy density is created? Well, it's for every one x particle, how many baryons do we get? Well, here, a fraction r of the time, we get b1 baryons. A fraction 1 minus r of the time, we get b2 baryons. A fraction 1 minus r bar of the time, we get minus b1 baryons. And a fraction r bar of the time, we get minus b1 baryons. And a fraction 1 minus r bar of the time, we get minus b2 baryons. OK, so if you just work it out, that's just B1 minus B2 times R minus R bar, okay? So here, the only point of this calculation is that it gives you another way to explicitly see where the Sakharov conditions are coming in, okay? So in order for this to be a non-zero value, we want this answer to come out to be 10 to the minus 9. To get a non-zero value, well, first of all, B1 and B2 have to be non-zero. This factor has to be non-zero. That's exactly the statement that this theory is baryon number violating. We have a particle here without well-defined baryon number. R minus R bar has to also be non-zero. Again, that's exactly the condition that the theory is C and CP violating. And then thermal equilibrium, where did that come from? Well, what we needed here was that after this particle froze out, the thing I didn't tell you about the temperature, about the scenario so far, but that also needs to be true for this calculation to be true, is that like the implicit assumption that's gone into this calculation is that when the chi particles decay and to produce these baryons, that the inverse process is negligible. There's that the thermal bath isn't simultaneously colliding baryons to make chi particles at exactly the inverse rate. If it had been in thermal equilibrium, that's exactly what would happen. If it had been in thermal equilibrium, the chi would be decaying to make baryons. That's great, but then the thermal bath would be finding baryons to collide together to create chi particles in the exactly balanced way. So you have to be out of equilibrium. You have to wait until the chi particle freezes out, the temperature drops below the mass of the chi particle. So suddenly the chi particle has this abundance that is very enhanced relative to the equilibrium distribution. so that then the amount of decay in this direction overwhelms the thermal inverse decay in this direction, and we can neglect it like we did in this calculation. Okay, so that's I think that's all I wanted to say, just that that's all we have time for in terms of baryogenesis, but that it's another thing you should, again, when you have your new theory of everything, it will be a great pat on the back for your theory, or it'll be a good constraint on the parameters of your theory, or possibly a way to rule your theory out if you find that it can or cannot produce the observed 10 to the minus 9 baryon to photon ratio in the universe today. And to do that, you see what you have to do here. You just have to scan through your theory and find, are there any particles, any massive particles, that would be created in the early universe, freeze out, and then decay, have two different decay channels with different baryon number, n states. And then you just have to go through, calculate the Feynman diagrams, calculate what are the branching ratios for those two decays and for the antiparticles, plug in, and go to Stockholm. Wait a minute, is Stockholm where the Nobel ceremony is? I always get confused. Some of the Nobels are in one city and some of them are in another city. I should know where the Nobel, where the physics Nobel is, but I don't. I think it is in Stockholm. But it could also be where? Oslo? So, okay. You don't think this is maybe the crucial thing for us to be talking about now? Why don't I stop now? As usual, for running over. I will really try to not run over next time, actually. Sorry, I didn't realize I'd run so far over.